Reaching Out, Chapter 2, A Receptive Solitude. Nuon suggests that the word solitude can be misleading, as if it was simply about being alone by yourself in an isolated place. We think of monks going and living in a monastery and being alone. But as he suggested in the last chapter, it's quite possible to be in the midst of people and to still be alone. Likewise, it's possible to be separate from people and not experience solitude. Solitude is clearly something more than simply being alone. Now, it's probably very difficult to move from loneliness to solitude without any form of withdrawal from the distractions of the world. And therefore, it's understandable that those who seriously try to develop this aspect of a spiritual life are attracted to places where they can be alone, sometimes for a limited period of time, or sometimes more or less permanently. But the solitude that really counts is the solitude of heart. It is an inner quality or attitude that doesn't depend on physical isolation. It's important to stress that solitude is one of the human capacities that can exist and be maintained and developed in the centre of a city, in the middle of a crowd, and in the context of an active and hard-working life. And the essential goal of this is that a person who has developed this solitude of heart is no longer pulled apart by the divergent stimuli of the surrounding world, but is able to perceive and understand the world from a quiet centre. It isn't too difficult to distinguish between the restless and the restful, between the driven and the free, between the lonely and the solitary. When we live with a solitude of heart, we can listen with attention to the words and the worlds of others. But when we are driven by loneliness, we tend to select just those remarks and events that bring immediate satisfaction to our own craving needs. Our world, however, is not divided between lonely people and solitaries. We constantly fluctuate between these poles, from hour to hour and day to day, from week to week and year to year. And we have to confess that we have only a very limited influence on this fluctuation. There are too many known and unknown factors which play roles in this balance in our inner life. But when we are able to recognise the poles between which we move and develop a sensitivity for this tension, then we no longer have to feel lost and can begin to discern the direction in which we want to move. And the goal of this inner solitude is an awareness of ourselves, an awareness of our desires and directions and gifts and strengths. Maybe one of the reasons that so many of us have to ask for support and advice and counsel from so many other people is in part due to us having lost contact with ourselves. When we're asking questions about what we should do for a job or what our profession should be, whether we should marry or remain single, or whether we should change jobs or move towns or houses, whether we should obey someone or follow our own desires, whether we should live a life that's poor or try and pursue money. Well, there really aren't enough counsellors in the world to help with all of these hard questions. And sometimes feel as if half of the world is asking advice of the other half, while both sides are sitting in the same darkness. However, by contrast, often our insecurity, rather than asking others for help, leads us to deal with others with self-defence. Sometimes it seems that gossip or condemnation of other people's behaviour, or even attacks on their life choices, are more expressions of our own self-doubt than of a solidly grounded conviction. Nuon tells the story of a young man who was asking advice about whether he should try and make a living as a poet. He says this: "You ask whether your verses are good. You ask me. You've asked others before. You send them to magazines. You compare them with other poems, and you're disturbed when certain editors reject your efforts. Now I beg you to give all of that up. Nobody can counsel you on the right thing to do here. You need to look into yourself and ask why you write. And if in this exploration you discover that you must write, then build your life according to this necessity." The suggestion is that no amount of outward affirmation will ever overcome that self-doubt, but an inward conviction, an inner sense of a calling or a vocation will overcome all sorts of obstacles. And I think that's very wise. I think people who've been able to make a difference in the world have been people with a deep sense of conviction of what they do. And how much of a contrast is that to so many of the rest of us who simply do things that people approve of, or simply do what it is we think that we're good at? Nuon suggests that by slowly converting our loneliness into a deep solitude, that we can create a space where we're able to discover that voice telling us about our inner necessities. which is our vocation. How many of us can claim that our ideas or opinions and our viewpoints are actually our own? Sometimes intellectual conversations simply boil down to the capacity to quote the right authority at the right time. And even the most intimate concerns, such as concerns about the meaning and value of life and death, can become victims to the fashions of time. Frequently we are restlessly looking for answers, going from door to door, or from book to book, or from school to school, without ever really listened and attended to the questions. To that young poet, he said, try to be patient towards all that's unresolved in your heart, and try to love the questions themselves. Do not now seek answers which cannot be given, because you would not be able to live with them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually live along some way towards the answer. But take whatever comes with great trust. And if only it comes out of your own will, out of some need of your innermost being, take it upon yourself. This is a very difficult task, because in our world we are being constantly pulled away from our innermost self and encouraged to look for answers instead of listening to questions. A lonely person has no inner time or inner rest to wait and listen. He wants answers and he wants them now. But in solitude we can pay attention to the inner self. This has nothing to do with egocentrism or unhealthy introspection, because what is going on in your innermost being is worthy of all of your attention. And in solitude we can become present to ourselves, and then we can live like a child or a saint in the immediacy of here and now, where every day and every act is an island washed by time and space and has an island's completion. But perhaps this is significant too, that in that place of solitude we can also become present to others by reaching out to them. Instead of being greedy for attention for ourselves or affection for ourselves, instead offering our own selves to help build a community of love. Solitude does not pull us away from our fellow human beings, but instead makes us real, makes real fellowship possible. Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, wrote that it is in deep solitude that I find the gentleness with which I can truly love my brothers. The more solitary I am, the more affection I have for them. It is pure affection and filled with reverence for the solitude of others. And for Merton, that solitude actually helped him to become more connected to the world instead of all of the busyness and distraction that we often fill our lives with. He became deeply aware of the needs and the pain of the world in which he lived. He wrote that though he was out of the world as a monk, he was in the same world as everybody else, the world of the bomb, the world of race hatred, the world of technology, the world of mass media, of big business and revolution and all the rest. But we take a different attitude to all of these things, because we belong to God. This inner solitude brings us to the realization of our own humanity, of our own part within the race in which God himself became incarnate. Merton's own personal experience taught him that solitude not only deepens our affections for others, but it's the place where real community becomes possible. Although Merton himself lived as a monk, first in a monastic community and later in a hermitage, it's clear that from his writings, what really counts for him is not the physical solitude, but the solitude of heart. Without solitude of heart, the intimacy of friendship, of marriage and community life cannot be creative. Without the solitude of heart, our relationships with others easily become needy and greedy, sticky and clinging, dependent and sentimental, exploitative and parasitic. Because without the solitude of heart, we cannot experience the others as different from ourselves, but only as people who can be used for the fulfillment of our own often hidden needs. The mystery of love is that it protects and respects the aloneness of the other, and creates the free space where they can convert their loneliness into solitude that can be shared. It is this solitude which can strengthen each other by mutual respect, by careful consideration of each other's individuality, by an obedient distance from each other's privacy, and by a reverent understanding of the sacredness of the human heart. In this solitude, we encourage each other to enter into the silence of our innermost being and discover there the voice that calls us beyond the limits of human togetherness into a new communion. In this solitude, we can slowly become aware of a presence of Him who embraces friends and lovers and offers us the freedom to love each other because He first loved us. Newman recalls an encounter with one of his previous students who came back to visit. He entered the room and he said, "This time I have no problems, no questions to ask you. I don't need your counsel or advice, but I simply want to celebrate some time with you." He says they sat on the chairs facing each other and talked a little about what life had been like us for the past years, about work and common friends, about our restlessness of hearts. And then slowly, as the minutes passed, we became silent. Not an embarrassing silence, but a silence that could bring us closer together than the many small and big events of the last year. The silence which grew between them was warm, gentle and vibrant. Once in a while we would look at each other with the beginning of a smile, pushing away the last remnants of fear and suspicion. It seemed that while the silence grew deeper around us, we became more and more aware of the presence embracing both of us. Then he said, "It's good to be here." And I said, "Yes, it's good to be together again." And after that, they were silent again for a long period. And as a deep peace filled the empty space between them, he said hesitantly, "When I look at you, it's as if I'm in the presence of Christ." I didn't feel startled, surprised, or in need, but I could only say, "Yes, it's the Christ in you who recognized the Christ in me." "Yes," he said, "indeed he is in our midst." It was for Newman one of the most remarkable experiences of community. Friendship and community are, first of all, inner qualities that allow human togetherness in the context of a much larger reality. They are not things which can be claimed or planned or organised, but we can, in our inner selves, create a place where they can be received, where they can exist as gifts, both for ourselves and to others. Once we have tasted this solitude, a new life becomes possible, in which we can become detached from all of the false ties that we live with, and attached to God and to other people in remarkable ways. Perhaps you could reflect back on times when you've been most conscious of an intimacy of friendship or of community. Perhaps you could think about the times when you felt most accepted, felt like you belong most. One of my realizations is that this very rarely comes from what someone else does for us, but it grows out of a relationship which has depth, so that I am confident in my place. Confident of being accepted and loved. I think as we move away from needing people to reassure us and affirm us and towards that place of inner solitude where we know our place, we know ourselves, we know our standing before God and before others, then we have much more ability to enter into meaningful relationships and places where we will find nourishment. This place of solitude is a place of deep communion with ourselves and with God. And that deep communion allows us a communion with others, not rooted in our own needs or grasping, but in an ability to connect and to understand the other and to serve and to give and to love.